So, the area of forgiveness. Now, this is a great topic for us to take on this afternoon, particularly within the context of families, but most significantly because it's within the context of the Bible lecture series. We take forgiveness absolutely, positively, seriously, not only because our faith literally depends on it, but it's also an issue of saying this is what connects us. We get high directives from the King himself, right? Jesus looks at us in chapter 6 of Matthew and he says, now here's the deal. He says, if you don't forgive other people's trespass, your Father in heaven won't forgive you. You forgive others, your Father in heaven won't forgive you. It's like Jesus is saying you have this little recorder around your neck, and every time you speak the curse of non-forgiveness to somebody, the recorder goes on, and at the end time, God says, let me have that recorder around your neck, right? Let me play that back. Let's see how you did. And we find out that's the statement that Jesus gives us, is that the standard which we use to forgive will be the standard by which we are forgiven. Man, I don't know about you, but that gets my attention right off the bat. So, you know, I've asked myself this question for a lot of years, and a lot of work that I've done has been gone into this, not only research-wise, but I was among, you know, one of the first in the wave, if you will, of psychological and clinical researchers on the area of forgiveness. Now, obviously, we've been talking about forgiveness for millennium, you know, in terms of what it means to our faith. But psychology hasn't always been a fertile ground for the idea of forgiveness. I remember one of my buddies in 1988 submitted one of the initial journal articles on forgiveness to a journal, and the editor wrote back and said, I like the article, I think it has a lot of merit, but forgiveness is such a charged word. Would you mind if everywhere you say forgiveness, we would substitute release of anger? We talked it over and thought, no, nothing's worth that, right? Nothing's worth that. Is that we're blazing this trail. I remember the first lecture that I did at a national conference on the area of forgiveness. This was about 1988, 1989. A woman at the back of the room was so objecting to the idea of using the word forgiveness in a professional psychological workshop that she looked at me and she pointed her bony finger at me and she said, forgiveness is the F word in the sexual abuse community. And I thought, well, okay. This is not exactly, in other words, fertile soil to make things grow. But, you know, things changed fairly dramatically in the next 5 or 6 years in the field of psychology. Psychology started moving out of that 1980s mentality of kind of toxic parenting and, you know, just scrape it off, you know, and forget about it, and revenge is the best thing. It started really focusing on a strength-based framework. And we had some significant donors that stepped up and gave to the idea, particularly the Templeton Foundation, saying, you know, we're going to fund some research on the area of forgiveness, particularly the scientific work of forgiveness. And all of a sudden, the psychological community started taking note, and they started publishing the articles with the use of the word forgiveness. They started really taking to heart the idea, something's going on here. They started noticing that people were psychologically more healthy around the idea of forgiveness. That people had more marital satisfaction, more relational success. They raised their children better. Their children ended up with less issue in terms of delinquency, in terms of staying in school, than those who did not forgive. All sorts of benefits started accruing because of the idea of forgiveness. We have found it as a major predictor, for instance, in marital success. Couples that forgive one another, you know, that's a couple that can stay together. Couples that can't, don't let things out of their sight, always keep that list going, they don't do so well. And here's the real deal, is that families do not tend to persist. What we know is that family cutoff is rampant worldwide, but particularly in Western culture, it still has the idea of scraping off, leaving alone, leaving that behind, not thinking about it anymore. You know, I come from Fuller Theological Seminary, the last place that Lewis Smedes wrote. Some of you are familiar with the foundational work that he wrote in the early 1980s called Forgive and Forget, in which he told us, you know, forgiveness is not the same as forgetting. Just trying to leave it behind is not the idea, in other words. Well, I not only was the psychological community noting this, but also the popular community was noticing this too. I remember a 2020 reporter, because I'd written a few books on forgiveness, they got in touch with me and they said, you know, we're doing this story on revenge, and we're looking for somebody to kind of give the other side of that. Oh, what, you know, a little 2-minute blip about forgiveness. And I said, well, sure, let's talk about forgiveness. And so I had my friend Fred de Blasio and myself, and we talked about this guy, and this guy kind of went back and forth. And he kept on calling us up, asking questions about the area of forgiveness for this 2020 story, because he had this book on revenge that was coming out on all the sweet delights that revenge produces, right? Well, after he kept on calling up and interviewing us, and is saying like this, and finally, my friend Fred said, it sounds like you're not convinced about revenge. And he said, I'm not, and it really bugs me. And he hangs up the phone. Well, he, to our surprise, went out and did a 100-person interview on the streets of New York, just walking up to people and saying, so, you have a chance to either forgive somebody or get revenge on them. What do you think is better? 92% of the people, 92 people out of 100 said, oh, yeah, forgiveness. Revenge will get you nowhere. He started thinking, he called back and he said, we're going to switch this story. We're going to make this story about forgiveness. And we're going to do a little blip, a 2-minute blip on revenge as the other side.
All right.
I'm telling you, we really start seeing dramatic difference. You're used to seeing forgiveness in everyday literature now. But that does not mean that we know exactly what it means. All right? We have the perception, and particularly in Christian circles, that forgiveness is about letting go. Right? Letting go. As Ev Worthington, one of my colleagues, and I think that this is, there is some truth in this, forgiveness means letting go of your right to hurt someone else back the same way that they hurt you. I can buy that. You know, letting go is a very, very popular idea. The problem is that I'm not quite sure that's what Jesus had in mind. We've acclimated ourselves to thinking that Jesus only had the idea of letting go. But here's the deal, is that the more that I've worked with forgiveness, and particularly in the area of integration of the idea of forgiveness, in other words, how did Jesus forgive people. Some of it has to do with letting go, but much more of it has to do with putting back. Putting back what? Well, putting back the status of love and trustworthiness. That's what we're going to be talking about over and over again. People get hurt in relationships because they have a violation of love or they have a violation of trustworthiness. Another way to say that is people get hurt in families. You get boogered up because you do not have a sense of your own identity because you weren't loved, or you do not have a sense of safety because things are not trustworthy. They're not stable. That's how people get hurt. That's the common denominator in families. So when we're talking about forgiveness, particularly the way that Jesus forgave, there are situations where he goes, I'm letting this go. But much, much more often, he's much more about, let's try to put this back. Let's try to put back a sense of identity and a sense of safety so we stabilize this for generations to come. Does this make sense? We're going to be talking about that type of forgiveness. Now, even though I'm going to talk about it in a more psychological way, I invite you, and I will talk about how Jesus forgave in certain instances, because I think that this model is compatible. Feel free to ask me questions or try to work these things out. This will make our session much, much more lively. We'll make it much more profitable as we go along, and we'll have a lot more fun doing it, right? And it'll keep us all awake because we have to dim the lights a little bit so you can see the PowerPoint and we don't want to get sleepy, right? Great. Okay, so one thing I have to do before I begin is I have to tell you a little of my background. It's sort of the touchstone of where I come because I am convinced as a clinician, I'm convinced as a researcher that forgiveness does us well. But I'm mostly convinced about forgiveness because it comes out of my gut. Particularly in families. My family was not a happy place. I didn't grow up in a really safe, secure environment. It's not that my parents, and my parents are still alive, by the way. My father is 88, my mother is 84. They still live in Amarillo, Texas, and they're still cooking, you know, so they're good. And we still have a great relationship. But if I went back 50 years in my life, that was not a very good place. It's not that they did everything wrong, because they did some things that were remarkably right. But the things that they did wrong were so profoundly damaging to me and my brothers and my sister that it was hard to get over. You see, my family was physically abusive. Now, there were a lot of times that were out of control in my household. But for me, the abuse comes down to this story, this kind of watershed event was when I was in the eighth grade that can kind of give you an idea of what it was like. In the eighth grade, I was having all sorts of trouble. I had just gotten the privilege of taking second grade over. I flunked second grade, so I was going to get to go again. I felt incompetent in my neighborhood. My brothers kind of bound themselves together. They were older brothers. My sister was a little bit too old for me, you know, so I was left alone, and I was desperate. I could not understand why my family so malfunctioned from what I knew it should be. And I got to tell you, I think I was clinically depressed. So at 8 years old, this clinically depressed 8-year-old goes into his family's bathroom. I pull out one of my father's double-edged razor blades. I pull up my sleeve. And I carefully cut into my forearm. Because, you know, even at 8 years of age, I know if I cut my wrist, I'm cooked. Right? Well, you know what I was wanting, right? I was wanting some kind of expression of love. Oh, we're going to get you some help. We care about you. Don't you know how much we love you? Well, what I got, my mother was the one that discovered me. When my mother discovered me, she was outraged. She grabbed my skinny little 8-year-old arm and jerked it up to her eye level. So I was just dangling in the air with my feet. And she took the razor blade and she held it to my wrist and said, if we're going to do the job right, this is where we need to touch you. I got to tell you, I felt this sludge of shame all the way up at the top of my arm, just soaked down all the way through my toes. Now, of course, my mother didn't cut me. But she did. Yeah. Well, you see, that day, I remember saying, never again will I venture out to try to get any kind of love. My one and only goal is to escape this family alive and hide myself and hide my iniquities and problems from anybody who might come along that would try to love me. Well, that was a bad choice for an eighth grader, right? You know, but the story doesn't end there. You know, I met Sharon in the eighth grade. You know, I became a Christian in the eighth grade. I started really learning and having a sense of community with some people that started taking care of me just for no good reason. And it certainly didn't happen in my family. I remember telling my parents that I'd become a Christian, and my parents literally went like this. And the thing they comforted themselves with is that, well, it's better than being out on the streets. Maybe. But it made me think again, you know, I'm on my own on this thing. I am alone. Just goes to show I should have never shared that with them, right? There's no hope of forgiveness with my family. But, you know, obviously I was being taken care of and starting to move into some other relationships and getting the slightest bit of vulnerability to the point where I married a wonderful woman. We had been married 5 years. Things were cooking along. I somehow found myself at a seminary thinking about how I was going to help people by becoming a marriage and family therapist, you know. And then I get the call from my mom that her father was dying of stomach cancer, and I had to go to New Mexico to see him for the last time. Now, so Sharon and I packed up. We were doing our duty. I wasn't so crazy about my grandfather, but I thought, okay, I'm supposed to be a marriage and family therapist. I'll do this. So I went, and I don't remember diddly about the weekend, but I do remember saying goodbye to my grandfather. I still have in my mind's eye, in fact, his deathbed, you know, over on the side, you know, my mother kind of over to the side of the bed by the closet, my wife kind of behind me, Sharon, and I thought, well, you know, I'm the therapist in the group, let me at it. I'll say something meaningful. I walked up to his bedside, I leaned over, looked him in the eye and said, I can't remember exactly what I said, but I think it was, take care of yourself. Wow. My mother stepped up to his bedside next, and she grabbed his hand and she patted it and said, Daddy, I'll see you next week. She steps back. And then my wife, who only knew this man about 5 to 7 years at the time, but she knows the extraordinary pain of not being able to say goodbye to loved ones. She steps up to his bedside, and she takes his big basketball-sized face into his. My grandfather was a rancher, and he was almost 300 pounds, but he wasn't overweight. He was almost all of that was muscle. He was a huge man. She takes his big basketball-sized face into both of her hands. She leans over and looks in both of his eyes and says, "I love you, and I will miss you." Well, I'm standing in the door, right? Well, I remember my grandfather just went. He just stiffened, had no idea how to respond. And then I looked at my mom. She was all stiff. And then I became painfully aware how stiff I was, right? You see, this lovely woman had blown the cover off of that. You see, it wasn't 5 minutes after I left that room that I thought, that's what I wanted to say. That's what I wanted to be able to say. But you see, there were far too issues between me and my grandfather. You know, my grandfather, he never once called me by my correct name. I have an older brother named Gary. He always called me Gary. You know, he never thought I could work. He always excluded me. He didn't come to my wedding. There were a lot of issues between me and my grandfather. But the truth is that those issues that were between me and my grandfather were the exact same issues that were between my grandfather and my mother. And those issues that were between my grandfather and my mother were the exact same issues that were between my mother and myself. I started thinking, man, it's going to be my parents' turn on that bed at some point. And I don't want my last words this time around to be, take care of yourself. But I don't want to have to lie either. I want to be able to heartfelt look at them and say, I love you and I will miss you. Mm-hmm. So what I'm going to share with you along the way is sort of the tail of the tape. You know, this stuff works philosophically, certainly works spiritually, but here's the real test. Does it work down here? You know, so this is what I've learned also from down here in the process of telling you about forgiveness. Okay? All right, so we all okay? You know where we're headed today? Well, let's get started. The first thing that I need to teach you about the area of forgiveness is how people get boogered up, all right? Is because if you don't understand pain, you won't clearly understand what you're trying to do in terms of getting people over their pain. And if you don't know what the pain is, you aren't going to be very good at helping people get over it or getting over yourself. This idea of just forgetting it you will find yourself committing the same type of errors over and over again. You know, Sharon and I work from a framework called the Restoration Framework. It's really based on this idea of love and trustworthiness. But we would say that love is essential. These are the two key ingredients for any family, any culture. These are what make things work. Love is important, not just because it's love, not because it just attaches you, but love tells you who you are. Just think about your Sunday school ideas about love. For instance, that idea of Eros love. You know, we usually think of it as an erotic type love. Actually, it's a self-gratifying love. I'm so fascinated with you. It quenches the desire. Like if I'm dying of thirst, I'm just like, whoa, man, did I Eros that water? In other words, it fulfills that very desire. And you can see why we kind of associate that with puppy love, you know, because we get fascinated with people, you know, we just think, oh, you know, I'm so excited to write my name with their name or, you know, imagine what they smell like, you know, the way that they dress, the way they comb their hair, all that kind of stuff we get really fascinated with. Well, you do this with children also, don't you? Don't you get fascinated with those young babies as they come into your life? You know, it's like, you know, can you imagine how cute those fingers are? Look at those toes, you know, look at that mouth. That mouth is perfect. Well, and you know, you scoop them up in your arms and say, oh, I'm so lucky to have you, you know. Well, if you are the recipient of that kind of love, you know, children grow up and they think, you are lucky to have me. Aren't I special? I am the scratch to your itch. Right? They learn that they are particularly unique. They have something special about them. That's my favorite bumper sticker, by the way. You are absolutely unique, just like everybody else. But that's true, right? That idea of agape love. You know, we usually think of agape love as kind of an unconditional acceptance. And it, you know, that's part of the idea, but that's not the key component of an agape. Agape love is sacrificial love. Is that I make sacrifice for you, even though I have the same exact need. Like if Jessica and I are both starving to death in a concentration camp, and we have one plate of food between us, if Jessica eats the food, she survives. If I eat the food, I survive. If we split the food, we both die. Agape says, you eat the food. In other words, it's putting ourselves on the line for the very thing that we need. And of course, this is why Christ loves us deeply and passionately with this agape type love. Does that make sense? Well, if I'm not made to feel guilty, you know, CFC tends to, you know, have that puritanical idea that if you're loved, you ought to feel guilty about being loved. No. When people sacrifice for you freely, it should make you feel worthy. Like, man, I must be important. I must be of great worth for that kind of sacrifice. I hope that's what you feel when you consider Christ's death. This is that you must be worth it in the end. Does that make sense? Now, what about this idea of phileo love? Does that have anything to do with identity? I think so. Belonging is a great psychological need that we need. How do we learn that we're really not alone? Well, that's why, you know, I would just tell you practically, it's by having good friends, right? When you have a friend that is deeper than a brother or a sister, you kind of know it, right? You know, those of you that have best friends, besties, right? Think about that best friend for a moment. Some of you in this room, you haven't seen that best friend in months, maybe even years. If you got together with them today, or you called them today, where would you pick up? Yeah, you'd just pick up right where you left off. You wouldn't have to say, well, let's get to know one another and see how this works out. And you would just pick up and move, yeah, because you know each other so well. In fact, when you have been loved in that way, there's a good argument that says you're never quite alone again. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And certainly you do this with family members. I remember what a surprise it was to me that my daughter was not me. Nor was she my wife. And for us, that became particularly noticeable quite early, about when she was about 3 and a half. She started developing skills and talents that did not belong in our wheelhouse at all. I started thinking, man, I want to know more about her opinions, her thoughts, her process. And got to know her like a friend as well as a daughter. Does that make sense? So you on board? Love teaches us who we are. And I would tell you that if you think that you're unique you think that you're worthy and you think you belong, you probably have a pretty good self-image. But of course, none of us grew up in places that gave us that perfectly, right? You have doubts about yourself. Maybe it's about your worthiness. Maybe it's about your uniqueness. Maybe it's about your sense of belonging. But that's where we get attacked most often. But I also want to guarantee you is that as bad of a family as you might have come from, you didn't grow up devoid of this kind of love. If you did, you wouldn't have survived. Right? Well, okay, so that's only half the story, right? Because we're also talking about trustworthiness. Trustworthiness is the other key component. We know about love, but we don't know too much about trustworthiness. Trustworthiness, these are key components that we have to tell us that we're safe. If we're not safe, we don't do business together. We don't give love a chance, in other words. I'm not going to hang around for you to love me if I don't think you're safe. What do we have for it to be safe? Well, three things, basically. The idea of predictability. Predictability, I have to count on you showing up the same way about 9 out of 10 times within that reliability. You don't have to be perfect, but you do have to be reliable in that predictability. You know, what we know stunningly about children is that children demand reliability, predictability. Or they don't function well at all. You know, these kids that, let's say the kid is a latchkey kid, comes home at 4 years old and he opens the door and he doesn't know what kind of parent he's going to have behind the door. You know, maybe mom or dad's going to be drunk. Maybe I'm going to have to take care of mom and dad. Maybe mom and dad's going to take care of me. I don't know. This is what we know is the kid that knows what kind of parent is going to be behind the door, even a bad parent, those kids do better than ones that don't know, that have to guess every day. Predictability is key. Of course, it's better if the parent's going to take care of the child. But even a predictably bad parent, a kid can adjust better to that than a chaotic parent. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. In other words, I can adjust my sense of safety. You know, the idea, I'm going to skip down to this idea of openness. Openness is important. You know, I can't keep secrets if I'm going to be safe. You know, I either know or I don't know. If you're not vulnerable with me, if I don't know the real McCoy behind who you are, I'm not going to feel safe. You know, this is why particularly affairs are so devastating to people. It's like a dagger in the heart of trustworthiness. You told me that I was your one and only. Yet, I found out you gave that to somebody else, right? I can't. How do I know when you're going to be honest with me? Openness is absolutely essential to the idea of safety. But the real key kingpin in terms of trustworthiness is the idea of fairness. This is for some of you that sometimes get a little mixed up or a little bit concerned about the idea of justice and love and that they don't fit together. You know, this is the idea of justice. It's like, you know, God did build things to be fair. I know that John Kennedy, a long time ago in a campaign, said, you know, life is not fair. And we've been saying that, we've been repeating that to each other ever since that time. Actually, it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be. And here's the idea that it's built upon. If you think of relationships, that in any relationship, but particularly family relationships, it's like a ledger that comes up. There are things, in other words, that I'm expected to give in order to make the relationship work, in other words, to perpetuate the relationship. But if I give those things, then it's fair for me to expect to receive something. This is called give and take, right? I'm entitled to give and take. That's why we're set up this way in this kind of framework. We become mutually interdependent. We have to depend on one another. We have to get this stuff with one another. So, you know, so let's just take a simple relationship that, like the one that exists between me and Sharon. simple because it's a relationship of equals. You know, spouses should be equal, friends should be equal, colleagues should be equal. So what would you say is fair for me to expect from Sharon in our relationship of give and take? What are things that I'm entitled to receive from her? Honesty?
Respect.
Love.
Care. Yeah, I mean, that sounds good, Sharon. we could make a much bigger list of those things, but you get the idea. Now, if Sharon provides those things for me, what's fair for me to expect to give to her?
Same thing.
Am I expected to give? Yeah, you'd probably say, well, Terry, the same things. Well, you see, that's the idea. Fairness between is actually the balance between give and take. Over a period of time, what that does is that builds up a resource of trustworthiness. Why is that such a magical thing? Well, trustworthiness over a period of time, just like a resource in a bank, allows me to lean into the stability. My bank account is not always drawn down, in other words. And it frees me up to say, I believe Sharon will give to me on a continuing basis, so therefore I am free. Instead of worrying about what she gives to me, I am free just to worry about what? What I give to her. That's the idea. It frees me up to give. That's why it's such a golden resource. That's why it creates a safe environment. I'm not concerned about what she does. She's safe. I trust her. Therefore, I can just concentrate on my side of the fence by my giving. That's why it's such a magical resource to the idea of relationships. But let's say that I give all these things to Sharon and she doesn't do squat. She does nothing. What would I feel?
Resentment.
Resentment. I'd feel a lot of resentment, right? Why? Yeah. I'm being cheated. I'm being cheated. This is not fair. I'm giving all this stuff and you're not giving anything. Whew. That's usually a motivation for anger, gang. You know, resentment, anger. You know, I'm going to play that out. It's not going to be pretty, right? Well, let's switch that around. What if Sharon gives all these things to me and I don't do squat? I don't do anything. What do I feel? Not her, but what do I feel? I should feel guilty, right? I always have to share this. We had an old seminary professor. His name is John Draker. He was ancient when we had him, you know. But he used to look at us and he used to shake his bony finger at us. He says, "You don't feel guilty. You are guilty." I think, yeah, it's true. If I do this, it's not that I just don't feel guilty. I am guilty. I'm violating. I'm cheating her. And what kind of constructive things do I do when I feel guilty? Yeah. I justify myself. I manipulate situations to get more guilt lathered on. Well, I give a lot to you. You just never notice it. You say I don't cook any meals. Every time we cook out, I cook. What? You getting the idea? In other words, I don't actually become any less destructive when I'm the one that's over-benefiting or I'm the one that's under-benefiting. Well, you see, here's the deal, is that where there's anger or guilt, there's an emotional drive to address the relational imbalance. That's all emotions are, is that when there's an imbalance, you get this tremendous drive to say, I'm going to address the relational imbalance. The problem is that when you address the relational imbalance, that's usually in quite destructive means. It's usually a threat, a manipulation, or a withdrawal. In other words, I get in your face and I say, you better give to me or I'm going to beat you up. Or, you think maybe you could do something just every now and again, just by accident? Get manipulative. Or I just say, we're done. I'm done. I'm finished. Okay? Does that make sense? This is what is the heart of it is called destructive entitlement. You know, in the relationship, in other words, in the relationship with this Sharon, I am entitled to certain things. I am entitled to certain things. But when I go about getting them destructively, I'm no longer in this trustworthy situation where I give because she's safe and I'm concentrating on my side of the fence. In destructive entitlement, saying, I'm going to manipulate you, I'm going to threaten you, or I'm going to withdraw from you until you give what I want. That's the difference between destructive entitlement. Does that make sense? Man, let me tell you, nothing destroys relationships like these kind of destructive actions. Because we booger up people bad when we threaten, manipulate, and withdraw. And by the way, don't think that threat is worse than withdraw. All of those are equally as damaging to a person. Well, that's in easy relationships. The problem is that families don't come from easy relationships exactly. You know, marriages come from those relationships, horizontals, relationships between equals, like we just described. The problem is that relationships from families also come from vertical relationships between successive generations. Mother and child, father and daughter, right? Well, how does that work in here? Yeah.
I was just thinking this is a result of threat, withdrawing, manipulation. That happens in churches a lot, too, because we act like a big family, and you'll see people threatening to leave. You'll see people threatening all kinds of stuff. Well, I'm just not going to talk to you anymore. I won't give my money anymore. Manipulation. Well, I'm going to go and talk to so-and-so if you don't do what I want, and then you're going to see how that happens. So this is just a big, messed up family.
Yeah, what'd you say? Yeah, absolutely. Just because we're applying this to family relationships today does not mean that it's not absolutely perfectly applicable to every system that you look at. It really is. You can put it on a global level. You can put it on a national level. You can put it on a community level. Certainly you can put it on a church level. You can put it on a family level, too. Yeah.
It almost seems then when you actually end up with this kind of an attitude, if you will, or you draw the line, not only does it affect a relationship and destroy a relationship, but it doesn't stay contained within that community.
Yeah, that's the problem. That's what I would say. Churches are more like these relationships that are asymmetrical, because you're not, I hope that you're not doing church for the person sitting next to you in the pew. I hope you're doing church for the people that you will never see that are going to be sitting in those pews or something like it. That's the great legacy that Christ has invested in, is the intergenerational transfer of grace. Well, it really is necessary for us to get a handle on this. Well, let's take a look at this. So what if Sharon and I, what if, you know, God did the Abraham and Sarah thing with us and we suddenly had a three-month-old. You know, what would you expect me to give that three-month-old? What would that three-month-old be entitled to, in other words?
Protection,
food, clothing, shelter,
love,
time,
discipline.
Yeah, all that, all good stuff that y'all are talking about, love, nurture, time, discipline. These are just a few of the things that we've put up here. Well, what does that child, you know, because, you know, the child's entitled to those things. I'm in agreement with that. What does that child owe me?
Nothing.
What am I entitled to?
Nothing. 3 months, nothing.
Yeah, you got it. You got it. That's true. Even if the child is non-responsive, you would say, well, if that child doesn't smile somewhere in those 3 months, you don't have to give these things anymore. You say, you've got to go the distance, buddy. Right? Now, the question I have for you, is that balanced? No, it's not balanced. But is it fair?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, you say, well, it's fair. Why is it fair?
Because you don't expect a three-month-old to cook and clean and take care of themselves.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know...
It's fair because you brought them into the world.
Hmm?
It's a privilege to be a parent.
Well, maybe. But I might be unconvinced after I go a few nights without sleep. I might not think it's such a privilege. You're investing for the future?
And that child
like,
doesn't have the capacity to do these things.
Yeah, but you know, I didn't grow up in a great family. I don't have much capacity either.
But you have responsibility.
Well, maybe.
What about you get commitment? A lot of joy.
Maybe my commitment, maybe it's a lot of joy.
You receive a lot of joy from that child.
Yeah, but a lot of heartache too.
But isn't there some self-fulfillment within that?
Well, not if you grow up in a crazy place like I did.
But it almost gives you a chance to give what you were deprived of.
Well, stick with that idea for just a second. Why is it fair?
And isn't that provided that you even recognize that the way you grew up could be cyclical and you actually break that cycle?
Yeah, but, you know, I'm a pretty sick cowboy. I don't really understand those things very well.
At some point, you got to suck it up and grow up. And your gut tells you you have to do it differently.
You've got to do it.
The option is that or go to jail. I mean, it's like at some point, you just got to suck it up and go,
it's the right thing to do.
Right.
But it's more than that. To me, this is where the difference between the faith and the non-faith. There's another kind of commitment that comes in here. Not just self.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah,
we've had a thought in our family for years. Fairness is not always being treated equally. I may need this, and my sister may need this.
Yeah, but remember.
And also, my mom had this thing about, you know, a lot of people say you go 100% in marriage, or you go 50-50 in marriage. Her idea was sometimes it's 60-40, sometimes it's 30-70. So I think that would fit in with this baby and adult intergenerational thing.
So I just got to hang around until the child's more capable to give back to me.
I'm hearing it.
I agree with it. I there's a lot of what I'm agreeing with here.
Well, I was listening to something the other day that was talking about this idea, and it's basically you're loving yourself because this child is the embodiment of you, and you're passing on your genetic code. And at this point, this is still so wrapped up in your own personal identity that it's as if you're loving yourself. When that child begins to talk back and fight back and tell you no, they're establishing their own and they're breaking from you in some sense, and you still try to love them and hold on to that. And that's why some parents squash them and won't allow them to grow and try to infantilize them or whatever that word is. And then as they mature, they have to allow them at some point because the child runs away emotionally or whatever other way if they do that too long. So at first, it's loving yourself, keeping this little thing as a part of you and seeing it as you and the thing that look like you, the kind of sort of maybe hopefully in some way smell like you or something. I don't know. And so you see yourself in them, and you project onto them the best of everything you have, hoping and praying for the future that they're going to be better than you. And so you want to
stick with that idea. Why would I hope that they do better than me?
Because now you're the one giving to them. You're not the screwed up parent that gave to you. You're better than
them. Yeah, see.
It's a different kind of love.
See, no, it actually is trustworthiness. If love and trustworthiness work, they have to work. In other words, balance has to work. But here's the idea, right? Is that there was once a time when I was a little shaker, and theoretically, there was a time where I needed love. Right? I just took it and I stuffed it. Didn't have to do anything with it. It was given nurture. What did I do with it? That time? That care? I don't have to do anything with it until I grow and I grow and I grow and I grow. I find a spouse and we have little ones and I go, oh, love. Yeah, I remember that. Oh, nurture. Wait a second. I got a little time in here for you. Let's see. Oh, yeah. You're asking for care. Way down there. There it is. And I give it to my children. What do they do with it? They don't have to give it back to me the same way I shouldn't have had to give it back to my parents. You see, it's actually not only balanced. It's not only fair, it's actually balanced. It's just not balanced like this way, like it is between me and my wife. It's balanced this way, through the generations, in the oscillating fashion. Does that make sense? Love is a different function. Love gives you identity. Trustworthiness gives you a sense of safety. Are you beginning to start to have an idea of why people get so screwed up? And it doesn't have anything to do a lot of times with how they were loved. It has to do with whether or not they were safe. Of course, you know, this is where it goes wrong. It's because in a family like mine, I didn't grow up in a situation where I got love. I didn't get any nurture. I certainly didn't get any care. And in fact, the family that I grew up in, my parents expected me to provide those very things for them. It was my job to make my mom and dad feel like they were important. It was my job to make sure that they knew how important they were. That it was my job to make sure that the house was taken care of and things were stable. So, this is just too bad, so sad for me. So I just end up with a hole here of what I rightly deserved, and I gave at the office already. What do you think I do when I come into the world then and have children of my own? What's my expectation? I already gave at the office. Your job is to love. Your job is to care for me. And you start seeing where I start becoming destructive. That if I don't get it from them, especially the way I'm looking for it then, you know, I'm sorry, gang. Your spouse can never love you like your mommy and daddy should have. They're good, but they're not that good. They're built to love you like a partner. They're not built to love you like a mommy or daddy. And certainly your children are not built to love you like a mommy or daddy. And when those children fail, you can see where the temptation comes in to threaten them, manipulate them, or withdraw from them. All destructive entitlement. The problem is that irreparably damages their sense of safety and their sense of identities. And it sets them up to do it in the next generation, just the same way. You get the idea of why the beat goes on, why it's so necessary for us to talk about destructive entitlement, particularly in the context of families, for you to understand that putting back love and trustworthiness is not just saying, oh, even Stephen, let's just count it for loss. It really takes some care and understanding, this is how people get screwed up.
Yeah, I want to say, however. The however part is when you realize as a parent you did kind of make those mess-ups, then the grandkids come along. And it kind of gives you another opportunity to kind of straighten out maybe what you messed up with your own son or daughter.
Always you're going to mess up. But I would not only say that with grandchildren, you always have an open ledger. You know, my 88-year-old father still has ability to talk to my identity and sense of safety. He still carries that obligation for me, and he still can speak to it. It's never a closed book. I am absolutely with you. Absolutely with you. This is not a once and for all set thing. If it is, then there's no use for forgiveness. It's like chapter 15 of Corinthians, right? You know, if the resurrection didn't happen, we're all cooked, right? We're all fools. If forgiveness doesn't work, we're all fools. We're saying, yeah, this can change. No matter what you did, you can undo. Yeah. Back here. Yeah, first of all, we have to be honest, all right? All right, so the first thing is that we don't stay jackasses all our lives. You know, we actually have the ability to grow and learn, and that is a remarkable fact. But we have to be honest with ourselves, too, and I hear you taking that kind of responsibility. I didn't do everything right. I didn't do everything right. And in other words, there's these areas that we do not see where we actually damage the coming generation when we haven't been able to do the work of forgiveness. You actively work on forgiveness? Well, you're less likely to make those kind of errors, on the big stuff particularly. And I would venture to say that's probably what you've done. But even the best of us that think we're so different than our family. You know, of course, my family is a family of anger, you know. I grew up in a terrible family of anger and perpetuation of violation and terrible, terrible things. And I got to tell you, I did a lot better job than my parents. Way better. My daughter was 22, and she was laying on the couch, and I told her something that I wanted her to change, and man, she lit into me. She said, I want to tell you where I grew up. I grew up in a house of anger. Well, you know, when she told me that, I really wanted to get angry, right? What? You know, but my thought process was like, what? What? I'll show you a house of anger, the house I came from. But here she was telling me just as straight, the way it played out for her was still a house of anger. You know, I did lots better. But the first thing that came to my mind is my mom, right in the middle of all this turmoil, right in my adolescence years, she would say, I was a good mother. You were a terrible mother. But I started hearing this in my head, you know. She thought she was a good mother because she had done a better job. Here I am, thinking I was such a better father. And my daughter's telling me what? Not so fast. Well, let's continue this discussion because we need to go deeper on it. We need to figure just those things out. Because it is hard to explain. But we also have to be honest with ourselves. We don't do things perfectly. Things slide through that we don't know about. We do get injured in ways that we don't know about. But, you know, our lineage will find us out eventually. Well, all right, I want to move on. So here's the framework that starts developing then when you're talking about family groups, right? You have violations that come from love and trustworthiness that results in for pain in the individual. In other words, they don't know who they are or they don't know they're safe. It results in those individuals then saying, oh, I got to react in some way. It's the old fight and flight syndrome, right? I am going to react when I'm in pain. It doesn't matter whether it's physical pain, it doesn't matter whether it's threat, or it doesn't matter if it's emotional pain. If I don't have a sense of identity or sense of safety, it is a deep emotional pain. What do I do with that? Oh, very constructive things. Very constructive things. First thing I do is I blame. Why was I not loved? Well, it's because you were an idiot. You were irresponsible. You're a monster. Everybody's out to get me. Not anything that has to do with me. It's everybody else. And that becomes habit forming, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. The opposite of that would be, why was I not loved? Well, it's because I'm not lovable. Mm-hmm. I'm a bad person. They were right in treating me the way that they did. I'm no good. I'm not worth anything. People should treat me like I'm worthless. And shame yourselves. People get very, very negative, very, very needy, very manipulative from that framework.
Can that be kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy? Like someone who's down on themselves, they can just continually keep down in that.
Yeah, those of you that are in the church, you know what this is like. You get a shamer in your office, right? It's like you're shoveling affirmation into them like coal dust, you know, and they're like a burning furnace. You shovel it in as fast as you can, and it's like, whoosh, it didn't matter. It's just gone because it can't fill the hole, you know. Well, God loves you. Yeah, I know God loves me. No, I care for you. Yeah, I know you have to say that. It's just terrible. When things aren't safe, what do I do when things aren't safe? If I'm a good American. Not only Americans. Well, I won't depend on you for anything. I'll just do it all myself. I will just make sure that I control how the bills are paid, where we go, where we live, how we do things, how we raise children. Those will all be my decisions. And if it's unacceptable to me, well, that's unacceptable. You'll have to do it my way. And if you don't like it, out of my way. Right? Sound familiar? I don't want to rag on us a little bit, but, you know, I'm going to have to just a little bit, is that you have to realize that if you're in the helping profession anyway, if you're ministerial or therapeutic or something like that, that a good percentage of you, about 70% of you, have this in your wheelhouse. You control things by making yourself invulnerable to others. The other extreme, things aren't safe. Well, things are not going to be avoidable. Always, always things are going to be awful. 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 So the best thing you can do is just anesthetize yourself to the pain, because it's not going to get any better. Life's going to screw you. Too bad. So, you know, at the light end of that anesthetization, you know, I'll eat too much, I'll shop too much, I'll sleep too much. When I start getting more serious about that, I'll drink too much, I'll drug too much, I'll porn too much, I'll gamble too much. If I get really wrapped up with that disconnection and escape, I'll just disassociate on you. I'll just go away. You won't be able to communicate with me. I'll leave every time I feel traumatized. Now, here's the bad news, gang, is that if you've been violated in one of these ways, you can do one of these. You can do two of them. Some of you are lucky enough to do three of them. Some of you, you went for the whole enchilada, right? You do all four of them. Right? Me, I'm a three-stepper. I take things too hard, personally, every time. It must be me. I'm so bad. I'm such a terrible person. But you see, that doesn't get me much. If I just get manipulative and needy and negative. So I try to perform my way out of it by controlling. Well, if I write enough books, or if I write enough articles, if I get enough degrees, none of those things work, by the way. Then I'll be okay. No, not okay. And when I get fed up with it never being enough to make me okay, that's where I lower the boom. That's where I get angry. And see, what do? When I shame myself, when I try to perform my way out of it, when I try to blame others, when I get angry, I just violate love and trustworthiness for somebody else. And I perpetuate this endless cyclical process. A family damaging family members. Do we have the capability of doing good? Absolutely. But even when you do well, it doesn't mean that you didn't do damage. This is the long-standing history of why families get hurt. This is where forgiveness has to take place. Psychology answers for a long time is that, well, if you shame yourself, will get you angry, particularly at the people that should have loved you. Hate them. We'll try to move you over here to blame. If you blame too much, we'll say, aren't you ashamed of yourself? Using power and control to dominate others. Aren't you ashamed of yourself? What do we try to do with controllers? We try to make them more chaotic. What do we try to do with chaotic people? We try to make them more controlled. If that doesn't sound like changing furniture on the Titanic, I don't know what is, right? Those things do not work because they cannot work. What you have to get at is the violation of the love and trustworthiness. This is what we're talking about. Where Jesus is really radical. Most of the places that he comes in and he's working the real truth and the magic of forgiveness, he's working in it from a perspective of saying, not let's let it go. He's working it from crazy statements like, oh yeah, you go sin no more. Are you so dense as a leader of Israel, that you don't get this thing? You must be born again? What are you, stupid? That didn't sound like forgiveness, does it? With these Pharisees, he says, you brood of vipers! And that rich young ruler thing, what must I do to be saved? Sounds like a sincere guy, right? Well, you know the commandments. Yeah, well, I've kept all those. Oh, before you go, one more thing. Sell everything you have. Come and follow me. What does the guy do? He goes away sad. Now, I imagine him going away sad Explain what? I'm leaving. Jesus does not go after him. Jesus goes, now, if we're to believe what Jesus says, if you forgive, my Father in heaven will forgive you. If you do not forgive others' trespasses, my Father in heaven will not forgive those trespasses that you commit. Then we got to assume that since Jesus is the forgiveness guy, all those are actually illustrations of him working his forgiveness plan. Concerning the idea of putting back love and trustworthiness. For the Pharisees, it was a harsh message, right? But there's something about that message that makes the Pharisee deal with truth. There's something about the reality of the confrontation with the rich young ruler that does not allow him to comfort himself saying, oh, I'm doing okay. As a worshiper of God, he cuts right to the chase and says, no, you're really not. You see how that's the work of forgiveness also? Because it's just as much the idea of justice, just as much as the woman caught in adultery or the woman at the well where he confronts and he says, yeah, don't do this anymore. I am not condemning you. I want you. But don't do this anymore. Make sense? All right, gang. So we're ready to start onto this idea, saying, okay, so you get the idea. Hopefully, you're seeing the idea that what forgiveness is not just letting go. It does involve letting go, but it also involves the idea of putting back love and trustworthiness, and the expectations and the way that you go about that kind of level of forgiving are going to be a little varied. I really, really believe that God does forgive us perfectly, right?
Amen.
But we are not exactly perfect at forgiving. So, therefore, you have to give some toleration to the idea of how do you restore family relationships with imperfect people? How do you go about that process? Well, if you think of forgiveness as more of this kind of a model, is that, first of all, the work of forgiveness involves two broad categories, the idea of salvage and the idea of restoration, all right? Now, in the idea of salvage, imagine the Titanic steaming across the ocean, going along its merry way, not watching out very carefully about where it's going, slams into an iceberg, it rips open the hull, watertight compartments fill with water, the ship lifts out of the water to the point where it causes stress and strains on the structure, it breaks into and sinks in about 3,800 feet of water. Well, we ain't raising the Titanic. In other words, it was lost. We couldn't find it for years and years until the late 80s when we finally found it. Man, the level of destruction was just phenomenal. There's no way. The water's too deep. The damage is too severe. You're not going to put that Titanic back in service. No way. But does that mean all is lost? Well, not really. I mean, if you pluck a plate off the ocean floor where the Titanic, the wreck site is, can you still use it as a plate? Yeah, sure. Sure. Even the decades that went by where nothing was salvageable, where we didn't get one physical object off the wreck site, we still salvaged out several things. We learned valuable stuff. One being, don't speed full speed across an ice field.
With your eyes closed.
Another thing is, it's a good idea to carry enough lifeboats for everybody to get off the ship. There's some handy things that we employed after the Titanic. In other words, there are things that we learned from the Titanic that do us good for the future. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So as applied to family relationships, it would be like this, is that there maybe are relationships and families that the damage is too severe. It's too complex. Things that you can't figure out. Where you have to say, man, I can't raise that thing up into a functioning relationship anymore. But that doesn't mean you can't do the work of forgiveness. It means that you have to look and say, how do I use, from the trauma of that damage, how do I use those lessons, use that knowledge in order to facilitate better in the future? Right? The woman that was at the back over here that was saying, I learned how to be a better mother. Right? Yeah. Partly what taught you how to be a better mother was the trauma that you experienced of salvaging out from your past. Make sense? Restoration is something different. So imagine the same type of situation. The Titanic steaming across the ocean, hits an iceberg. But this time, the ship sinks, but this time it's in 300 feet of water. And the hull isn't cracked open and all these strains and stresses happen, where it just basically filled up with water and sank. Well, with 300 feet of water, you see, it could be possible. You get divers in there, they plug up the hole, pump the water out, refloat the ship, haul it back to dry dock, have people work on it about a year, and take the actual ship that was lost and return it back to the service for which it was intended. That's restoration. When we're applying it to family relationships, there are relationships where the damage is not too severe or things are not too far gone, where you're able to plug that up. Now, it doesn't mean that the thing never happened. You can't restore a relationship where it never happened. What you can do is restore the relationship back to the status for which it was intended, to be loving and trustworthy. That's why the book is always open on it. Okay? All right, so the way that we think about this then in this model is to think about two stations that have to do something with salvage. Notice I call them stations. I do not call them stages because they're not stages. It's not like you proceed from insight to understanding to giving opportunity for compensation, because that's quite frankly not the way it works. People are all over the board on this. They do a little insight, they get a little understanding, they do a little giving opportunity for compensation, they do a little insight, they do a little giving opportunity, they do a little understanding, and one day they find themselves talking about things they never dreamed that they'd be able to talk about. In other words, it happens in various ways for different people. The same way that Jesus did not make everybody a disciple and a follower. Some people he obviously worked with, he forgave. Some people he set up to do the work of forgiveness. Some people he totally brought them in to a relationship with him. Does that make sense? That's what we're after. We're after being realistic, being redemptive in the family. But the work of forgiveness is always moving the ball forward. It's not saying that everything can have love and trustworthiness restored, but you're part of the plan on restoring love and trustworthiness. Is that reasonable?
Now, what about people that you that say you're forgiving or working on forgiving, and they mistake that forgiveness for weakness?
They mistake the forgiveness for
as
what?
A weakness on your part.
Yeah.
And then you have to deal with that.
Yeah. Like, you're not being a good Christian because you're not forgiving, or?
No, in other words, like, say, for example, you have someone in your family who you've forgiven, and because you've forgiven, you've chosen to be nice and kind. You don't necessarily give them your full undivided attention. But then in turn, they'll say, well, you're just being weak. That's why you're not acting the way you were before.
No, it's just a sign, if you forgive, that you're not tough enough to be
right.
Vengeful.
Right.
Yeah. We get accused of that a lot, don't we? we're foolish to forgive.
And that's it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. By the world's standards, we may look foolish. We'll see, right? Yeah, is that we can't correct that. In other words, I can't correct people's perceptions of what I do. All I know is that when I get down to this, I'm either going to be doing harm or I'm going to be doing good. You know, and it really boils down to that. Is that you have to realize that when we're talking about the work of forgiveness, you're going to have to choose at some point. You're either going to move the ball forward. Sometimes it's going to look different, but you're either going to move the ball forward with people or you're going to move it backwards. You know, there's a famous passage in Romans 8. You know, this just gives us... I love the way that Paul lines it out. He just puts it to us, right? The way of the Spirit is life. The way of the flesh is death. You choose. But those are the two choices. Well, so we'll spend the balance of our time then talking about these four stations and the different requirements that they have. So salvage is the idea that we take damaged individuals or we take our own damage. They experience justice. We try to give them power and control over the mechanisms of the pain and make some identification with the humanity, particularly the humanness of their victimizer. That's what the goal of salvage is. Those are the two things that we salvage out, is that I'm empowered enough not to do the same stupid thing that was done to me, if I can figure it out. Get that leverage. And number two is that I don't have to worry that my victimizer was some evil monster, sinister, evil, conniving person that I have to protect the world from, nor do I have to be a worm. We're both human beings, in other words. So, salvage involves two stations. The first station that we're going to talk about is the station of insight. This insight allows a person to objectify the mechanisms of family pain, which would cause the relational damage, so the mechanisms can be blocked and the individual can be protected. Think of it this way. If I'm out in the middle of a lake with a rowboat and a diver comes up underneath my boat and pokes it full of holes, after I plug the holes up, what better be my first concern?
He's going to come back.
Yeah, I better figure out how to stop him from doing that again. That's what insight is about. Is that I can't rebuild love or trustworthiness in a relationship until I stop the damage. If I can't figure out how to stop the damage, game over. In other words, the violation is just going to continue. I can't forgive what continually keeps on being violated. Mm-hmm. That's not forgiveness at that point. That becomes, at some point, foolhardiness. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The effort that we put forth in this probably depends on the value or the importance of that relationship to us. Someone may offend me, but if I really want a relationship with the person, I'm going to move on.
That's true, but particularly in family relationships, we have a bias toward them that we can't quite get unhooked from them. Mm-hmm. I may change my name, but I still feel an emotional tie to them. I can even cut off from them. I can move to the other side of the world, but I still carry this. We had this report from adopted kids over and over again. You know, that no matter, kids that were adopted, that were raised in great families, that ended up in great situations, they still report, I still have these two unanswered questions. Why was I given up? Who do I look like? Why was I given up? Who do I look, you know? That kind of questioning, it drives us, it's much, much more than just a biological question. It's a more of an emotional being question that we intend to get answers to. Even if we cut off, it doesn't answer those. Even if we say our family isn't important to us any longer, it doesn't necessarily make it so.
I'm not sure if I wrote this down right, so correct me if I'm wrong. You said you can't forgive what is still kind of coming at you. What did you say?
The violation that's continuing to occur.
Right. And so my question is, because I grew up in a family that's kind of similar to yours, except I would be the generation that your daughter is with the family history. Mm-hmm. And in my family, the violations are kind of a constant thing. And I'm gaining insight and seeing, okay, this is a problem, but the resolution is tough because they're not acknowledging the violations. And so what would you say for instances like that?
Yeah, in most cases, particularly with this insight, it doesn't, by the way, insight never requires me to have one conversation with the violator. In fact, most often I won't, because if I tried to, they'd reject it, right?
Right.
The idea here is that I learn how to protect myself with myself. I always had this question when, you know, I would go over to my parents' house. You know, for some crazy reason, my family, even though it was very destructive, we all felt like it was obligatory. We were obligated to show up twice a year to put each other through misery of seeing one another. You know, and I followed that lead for a long time, but it always would bug me. Here I'd be a man in my 20s or 30s. I would walk through the threshold of my parents' house, and all of a sudden I'd be eight again. And I think, what happened? It was because I was still giving my parents the unmitigated power to be able to govern what was going on with me. All I'm doing with insight is I'm becoming wise to saying, what are the mechanisms that when I walk through that threshold, do I start giving up? Where I start losing control of myself. You know, I told you that when I entered this marriage and family program, very quickly that death of my grandfather occurred, and I said, I'm getting some help. I'm going to work on this. And man, I did. I got in therapy myself. I got in some group therapy. At the time, I was in this little group therapy process group with my doctoral studies group. And, you know, what we did in those days is we'd go through each other's family of origin. And it was getting around my turn, and Thanksgiving was coming up. And I said, you know, I come from an abusive family, and I'm gonna go home at Thanksgiving, and I'm going to get this on the table. I'm going to get it. We're going to talk it out. Right? I remember my group of six were sitting around the table, and they were like, okay. Well, why don't we role play that for you? I said, yeah, okay. Yeah, that's fine with me. So I gave them probably the thinnest thumbnail sketch that you ever have seen in terms of just the names and players of my family members. And they said, okay, go outside for a few minutes. Come back in 3 minutes. I said, okay. And I walked outside and said, this is going to be a waste of my time. So after 3 minutes, I walked in the room, and the guy that was designated to play my father was sitting like this, like the door is over here. Was sitting like this, and he was staring at the monitor like it was a television. I walked in the room. He looked at me and said, hello. Went right back to watching the television. Well, I just crumbled. I just started bawling. Because I knew that's exactly what was going to happen with my family. See, my family handled the pain by disengaging them from one another such a destructive way that they could not contact a group of people together. They would all get together, eat, and then separate off in twos and go and talk about how much they hated everybody else. And I just saw that in that one moment, I said, this is going to be so passive. It's going to be like handling Jell-O. I'll never get a grip on being able to do this. So they were very constructive. They looked at me and said, well, we don't think you're quite ready to confront this. And so they started talking to me about, I said, I don't know what, I feel like I have to go. So they started saying, well, if you feel like you have to go, how long could you go and survive? I said, I just picked a number out of the air. I said, 2 hours. They said, go for 2 hours. I was like, you don't quite get it. We live in Texas. So the place I was driving to was 6 hours away from where I was. So you want me to drive 6 hours, stay for two, and drive back 6 hours? Mm-hmm. Go for 2 hours. Mm-hmm. So that's what Sharon and I did. We made up an excuse about work, scheduled ourselves to work. So we drove the 6 hours. I walked in to my brother's house. Guess what? He was watching television. My dad was watching television. He didn't say hello. He said, hey. And then he started watching television again. So I walked in and I thought, I'm just going to swallow hard, get this over with. So I said, Dad, I want you to know on the front end, we're only going to be here 2 hours because I have to get back to go to work tomorrow morning. He looked at me and said, you drove 6 hours to be here for 2 hours? I said, yes. He said, why would you do that? I said, because it's important that I'm here. You're only going to be here for 2 hours? Yes. Well, we better get going. Denise, Terry's only going to be here 2 hours. Pat, that's my sister. Yeah, my true brother. Yeah, he's only going to be here. He drove 6 hours. Just me. We better get down here on the table. All of a sudden, this passive man is making all these things happen. Sharon and I are watching this, and we're saying, whoa. We're getting some power here. We're getting some power. We're getting empowered over setting a boundary that we didn't think was particularly possible. Part of the reason that my family becomes so damaging is because we have no structure that ties us together. That those unstructured times are where we get the most damaging. So it just happened to be my turn to host the next family event. So 10 months later, I send out a schedule. This is what we're doing over the 8 hours that we're going to be together. Every minute was planned. Every minute was planned. I also, just to kind of make it complete, I sent along a rule book. and I cut out cartoons, and I made it kind of funny, but there were some funny things in there, but also some rules of saying don't split up and talk about somebody else. Well, to tell you the truth, my expectation, you see, this was in order to protect me. I didn't want any more damage. I couldn't take this kind of distance of nothing. So I planned in order to protect myself. Well, my expectation was not one of them would show up. All of them showed up. And they would do it kind of funny. They'd come up to me and they would say things like, got your rule book. But by and large, people played by the rules. The next family reunion. My sister, guess what I got in the mail? A schedule.
Did it have a robot?
Yeah. It's the idea, you see, when we started talking. Now, we didn't have any conversation. Nothing changed except it became less damaging. When I started having a phone conversation with my mother or my father that was going south, particularly my mom, I would say, Mom, seems like things aren't going so great today. We'll try it again another day. See ya. But I got things to say. I know. See ya. Oh, I'm not trying to cut off from her. I'm telling her, I'm going to stay in relationship with you. We're going to try again, but not today. Not today. You see, because I started finding out that I had the empowerment. Not that I was causing the damage, but indeed I had the empowerment to stop her from damaging me. I didn't have that power when I was 8. I do have much, much more power. How do you do that? Well, you just simply pick it apart. What we call it in therapy is circular causality. So you just take ourselves, well, when you walk in the door, what happened? What happened next? What happened next? What happened next? What did you do? What did they do? What did you do? What did they do? What did you do? What did you do? And at the point where the damage occurred, you just back up 2 steps to say, what do you do? When you start seeing it coming, what do? So that you can avoid and protect yourself from those type of situations. You know, most of the problems that I started finding out, particularly with my mother, is that I would ask for it unknowingly, but I kept on searching for her approval. You know that shame in me that says I'm such a bad guy? I wanted her to pronounce me okay. Well, of course, she wasn't equipped to do that at the time. So every time that I would ask her in a coded way, well, I think I'm going to a marriage and family program at Texas Women's University. A women's university? Well, why in the heck am I asking my mother to give me approval to go to a women's university, right? Learning, gaining insight, empowers me to set the boundaries so I have more control. Now, I'm not going to have 100% control, but backing it up like this is teaching me over and over again, what are the mechanics that I can do something about and take a powerful stance on so that I stop getting hurt?
Can you talk about that going the other direction? So you did a lot better with your child or children than your parents did with you. So what are you doing to try to get insight into your relationship with your daughter and correcting those things?
See, now, I didn't plant you, but that's the idea. You found exactly the point. Why is that forgiveness? Because if I can learn how to stop somebody from perpetuating pain to me, I can also learn how I perpetuate pain to them. What makes me angry? How do I damage people? Well, I tell you how I primarily damage people. Why I usually get angry is because they don't do what I tell them to do. I want them to do differently. Now, it doesn't matter whether they're doing it right or not, but that's how I was injuring somebody. And I learned this deeply and passionately from my father, is just lay low and don't say a word. When something good needs to be said, don't say anything. That would be my dad's motto. And man, have I learned that. Well. So, I was thinking I was a good father because I was getting angry less or controlling less. Yes, I was a good father, but not as good as what I thought I was. Because I was still manipulating the situation where they would do what I wanted them to do. And I was being way too passive in speaking up and affirming words of who their identity was in Christ and in themselves. Does that make sense? When I become insightful about how I get my identity and safety hurt from somebody else, I start becoming much, much more insightful about how I can be stop myself from doing this work. Man, you put that in 30 years on top of one another, what you end up with is intergenerational forgiveness. You get a redeemed family out of that situation. Just not doing hurtful things is one way to reach forgiveness when you're talking about intergenerational transmission. Does that make sense? Yeah.
How do you say forgiveness and anxiety?
Well, anytime you don't know who you are or you think you're unsafe, you're going to have anxiety. Fear is part of the enemy, right? You know, that's why 1 John tells us that, right? 1 John says, perfect love does what?
Pass
out fear, right? So it's no surprise is that when you have imperfect love, you still have a lot of fear. And that's where we get mixed up. It's always, in my business, we call these things primary emotions. When things are unsafe, you're going to have anxiety. Yeah.
Is there an accepted norm that you would base off of? Because it sounds like a lot of this is in response to, you know, you've got this onslaught with DSM and all these different things. So then what would be, like, the ideal norm? You know, here's what a Christian would look like us on the teaching end of things could be focusing on and modeling.
Yeah, I mean, a good Christian is going to be convinced of two things. I always think of Tevye when I think about this thing. You know, remember Tevye and Fiddler on the Roof? He says, by our traditions, what we know who God is and who we are. In other words, I know the identity of what is, and I know how to practice this in relationships through traditions. Those are the two things that we do. So it's practice safety. I'm safe with other people, and I infuse in them the uniqueness, the worthiness, the belonging that I look for myself. That would be the broad between the ditches that I'd be looking for. Yes.
What would you say to a married woman or a husband who's unequally yoked? They're the believer, their spouse is not. And what their spouse focuses on is things like turning the other cheek and forgiveness no matter what I do to you, because that's what the book that you supposedly live your life by is telling you to do. How do they demonstrate Christ's love in a way that also protects them and their identity?
Yeah. Yeah. And those are the types of things. You know, Christ didn't give us the golden rule as a curse. He gave us the golden rule as actually a blessing. So it means that people can use it for manipulation into curses. You know, this is the Jesus that looks at the Pharisees. He looks them straight in the eye after calling them a brood of vipers and says, you want a sign? Let me tell you, the next sign you get from me is the sign of Jonah. And he doesn't speak to them again. In other words, he basically says, you want a sign? You know, watch for it. But he never speaks to them again. Now, I'm not suggesting that you don't speak to a spouse, but I am saying that you have to be wise in setting up the situation to say, I'm not going to concentrate on playing Holy Spirit in my spouse's life by making them try to behave, by manipulating them. At the other framework, it doesn't do me any good to have a good marriage just to respond to their manipulation. As soon as I sense manipulation, I go, nope, no response to manipulation. It's a, that kind of differentiation is absolutely essential. But you see how different that is between reason-based. Spouses know when they're being manipulated. They know when that's wonky, in other words, when somebody's making a heartfelt try versus when they're giving a manipulative try.
So then they would have to walk the fine line between not allowing that to become their manipulative response.
Exactly, exactly. I'm always concerned. You see, here's one thing that I want you to take to the bank. Victims, this is going to hurt. Victims are always also victimizers. The inverse is also true. Victimizers are also always victims. Just because you're the victim of somebody else's irresponsibility does not mean that you're free to get off scot-free, because you probably are lightly victimizing somebody else. And that victimizer probably always has a story of victimization that they carry. Yes?
So in the church, when you're dealing with people who are manipulators and threatening and all that kind of stuff, do you just give no response? Do you just, I mean, no, like, we're not going to... Okay, I've heard you threaten that you're going to leave the church. I'm going to take that as you're not happy with something, and if you want to leave, that's on you, but really, we love you, we'd like you to stay. Okay, so you're going to attack me, and you're going to threaten me with some whatever, and you're going to accuse me of all kinds of things. I hear all of that, but you're not happy. Now, what can I do with that unhappiness? I don't know, because you haven't given me anything valid yet. You're just attacking. So in that way, you shut down their manipulation techniques?
Yeah, or I quit responding to their manipulative techniques. I hear that you need to leave. Yep, maybe so. We want you to stay, but maybe you need to leave. I understand that if that's the case. You want to attack me? Well, I can guarantee you, I'm a far worse person than you think I am. You know, if you don't believe that, talk to my family. You know, but be that as it may, you know, that cannot. I can't be blackmailed by my own sinfulness. In other words, I let those secrets out all the time. Those kind of things loosen you up. In other words, I'm going to protect myself from those kind of manipulative frameworks. All right, so let's move on a little bit. So you get the idea of insight. It's not magical. It's kind of long-term. It's sort of like saying the way that we fix things is through the intergenerational process. But I don't want you to think of that as weak forgiveness. Like I said, that kind of lack of damage in 30 years, basically 2.5 generations, will get you a redeemed family. I've seen it 100 times. I've seen it 100 times. People intentionally gaining the insight to do better than what was done for them. You know. Understanding. This is the second deal. Again, this has no relational requirement. I can do the work of insight and understanding without ever having any conversation with the person that I feel like has done me wrong. Understanding allows a person to identify with the victimizer's position. Also, looking at their timeline, their life limitations, their development, their efforts, their intent. When you see that kind of development, background, limitations, then it opens you up to the possibility that maybe this victimizer is more like you than what you first thought. If you face your own fallibility, then it identifies you as probably that person is not so evil. You know, I told you my one of my deals with my mother, she used to say, I was a good mother. You were a terrible mother. Until I started listening to the stories about that 300-pound rancher. And some of the stories that of the way he raised her. You know, he was a tough old bird. But, you know, his idea of discipline was that, you know, these cattle bars that would go in the back of a pickup truck to move small livestock, he'd tie his children to those bars and drive over rough roads, the roughest roads he could find, to beat them up. Then he would tie them to the barbed wire of the fence and beat them with a strand of barbed wire. And leave them there for the rest of the day to the hot sun and the bugs. Now, that's just one illustration, one that I can tell you in public. Well, you know, when I heard a few of these stories, you know what I thought about my mom? I actually thought, well, you're right. You did better. Now, that does not alleviate my mom of the responsibility of the choices that she made. In other words, she did a dreadful wrong. My father did dreadful wrong. But understanding the story tells me that she wasn't some evil monster, some maniacal witch that was trying to figure out how to hurt people, even though that's the way I thought she was. She was a woman, much like me, who got her heart boogered up, who made some really, really bad choices, ended up injuring me. Hearing her story makes me realize she's human. You know, some of you are familiar with the author Scott Peck. Scott Peck wrote the book, A Different Drummer, you know, a revolutionary book, in terms of pop psychology. But he also wrote a book called People of a Lie. In that book, it's worth a read, is the idea that people are not as evil as what you think. People, you know, in other words, truly evil people, you probably will not run across one in your life. Most people are like people that get injured in terrible ways and make dreadful, dreadful choices. But they're not monsters. Because if you look at it this way, there's no way that I can hold a monster responsible for his or her action. Because what are monsters created for? I'll get to you in just a second. What are monsters created for?
Destruction.
Yeah, they're created for destruction. The only thing I can do is kill the monster. There are not very many of those. Actually, there's a lot more of people like us who make dreadful, dreadful errors that we need to be held responsible for. My mom, my father, they need to be held responsible. That's what good forgiveness holds responsible. That's what Jesus kept on saying to us. Jesus didn't say, grace for everybody. What does he say? I am the vine. You are the branches. Apart from me, you can do nothing. Every vine that produces much fruit is connected to me. Every vine that does not produce fruit, what? It's cut off, thrown into the fire. It glorifies my Father in this, that you become my disciples. I don't see how you get much clearer than that. You know what he's saying is, it's not just grace for everybody. That is the story, isn't it? Thank God, grace is the story for everybody. But it's also the story that says it comes with a caveat. you gotta be in the vine. You gotta change your life. You gotta be grafted in. Yeah, at the back.
So was your grandfather evil?
Hmm?
Was your grandfather evil?
Absolutely not. He was a guy a lot like me. He was not an evil man. He was a victim of the family that he grew up in. You know, I always have this wonderful story. I moved to, my first academic job was at the University of Mississippi in Oxford, Mississippi. I moved there. I was thinking, nobody in my family's from Mississippi. I'm opening up a new phase of my family's life. My mother had been doing some genealogy work after I'd moved there for about 6 months. She called me up and said, "Terry, I think my people are buried there." I said, "Your people? What do you mean, your people?" And she says, "Oh, I think all of them." Sure enough, on our next trip, we went to Corinth, Mississippi. We went to this small church graveyard, just rows and rows of Andersons that, you know, is my mother's maiden name. And there I stood right in front of my grandfather's headstone, a Confederate headstone. I thought, you know, the irony of this is that I have more in common. I think more like this guy. I probably look more like this guy. And I probably have a history more like this guy than anybody else in my current existence. And he's 60 miles away, and I never knew he was here. You know? That's my grandfather was this man's son. He's not too different than me, I think. I don't think he was evil. You know, maybe there are a few evil people out there. You know, maybe Stalin, maybe Hitler were truly, truly evil. I don't know. But I don't know any. Yeah. All right? Well, understanding starts opening up that. Now, this is the magic pill about forgiveness. This is the most researched form of forgiveness that we can find. Because when you start understanding your victimizer, you get this thing called compassion. When you are compassionate toward your victimizer, you start loosening the bonds of pain that surround your heart. You start loosening the bonds of pain. You stop thinking. You stop fueling that anger like there's some monster. I stop fueling my shame about how I'm such a worm. And all of a sudden, I start releasing the pain. That pain frees me up to not be so concerned at retribution. It makes me understand I need to be concerned about my responsibility. As far as my parents, well, I understand a little bit more about them. I still expect some things from them. I still need to protect myself from them, maybe. But I don't go under the idea that they had some vendetta against me, that my grandfather really had some issue. You remember what I said? The issue that I had between me and my grandfather was really the issue between he and my mother. That issue is that basically he never expressed one ounce of care for me. I suspect, well, no, stronger than that. I know that's because no one ever expressed one ounce of care for him. Does that make sense? Questions on the idea of understanding? You see how we get there? So even if these people are dead, I can open that up level to understanding. I can talk to people that did know them. I can find out about their background. I can do investigation on who and where and what they are. When I start making that connection with your story, I guarantee you, when you make connection with your story, you will engender compassion if you also mix it with responsibility. If you say, "I still hold you responsible, but I don't feel the anger any longer." Yeah.
I was just thinking about your grandfather. That would also remind me
assigned us to put it in the proper time frame. You can't hold them accountable to what today you don't touch your child, in the sense of most people won't spank their children or anything like that. Whereas back then, it was a much stronger discipline. That would have not been acceptable, but yet much, much stronger than it is today. And even further back, it gets more and more in that light.
Yeah. I think that that is true. You know, you do have social standards that do change, but I do think that we, you know, again, I want to say broadly, you know, as Paul says in Romans 8, there's the way of the spirit, there's the way of the flesh. And, you know, I got to believe that he knew that that was the way of the flesh. All right? All right, there we go. So salvage enables the victim to stop the future damage, limit the intergenerational transmission of the damage, and deal with some of the aspects of guilt and shame. However, it does not require further development or involvement in the relationship between the victim and victimizer. In other words, it may be too deep. These people may not be reasonable. I may not be able to communicate with them. I'm glad Jesus didn't say, oh, well, let's sit down and have a longer discussion, you Pharisees. In other words, there was a point where he engaged that, but there was a point where he said, that's enough. That's enough. I'm not going to engage this. Do what you have to do, but you have to reckon with yourself. I got to believe that that had an effect that set those guys up down the line for many of them to believe. Because they said, you know, the thing that I can't shake. Remember what he said, that the next sign you get from me is the sign of Jonah, that 3-day thing. I can't shake that he said that, because that's the last thing that he said to us. Could you imagine it drove them nuts? I remember the story that my mother told me to my sister who died of cancer. 3 months before she got a diagnosis of terminal cancer, my mother was talking to her, and like they did most of the time, they argued much. They never got their issues settled before this cancer diagnosis. But my mother said to her just before she hung up the phone, "Well, you're going to have to live with this a lot longer than me." That was 22 years ago. My mother's had to live with those words still stinging their ears. Right? I gotta believe Jesus set these guys up to say, didn't he speak to us? Didn't he leave us with those words? Restoration, though, is a very, very different thing. Because here it is, gang, is that if you restore the relationship, you cannot put yourself in a position of restoration, actually restoring the relationship to love and trustworthiness without breaking some eggs, without putting yourself in harm's way. If you're going to restore the relationship, you have to make yourself vulnerable. If you make yourself vulnerable, then the very victimizer that damaged your sense of identity and damaged your sense of trustworthiness has the chance to do it all over again. You know, that would just be like me saying, give me your hand. And so he gives me his hand, and I take out a knife, and I slash his hand. And then I say, I have something in my pocket here that will fix that. Give me your hand. Yeah, you're trusting in the victim. Most of us go, no, let me see your hand. That's the kind of problem that we have in restoration. We sometimes obligate ourselves to do unwise things because we have this idea that if somebody asks for forgiveness, that's the magic bullet. We have to forgive. Well, we do have to forgive, but there are different ways to forgive. It's not always necessarily that will restore justice or trustworthiness. It does mean that we do need to work the work of forgiveness. It doesn't mean that we always crawl back in the relationship where we make ourselves vulnerable to get hurt all over again. There's a hand up.
So is restoration with the realization that
you know, when damage has occurred, and let's just say the best case scenario, they recognize, they get insight, they get understanding, they've covered the bases, that the relationship might be in a different direction than what they would have expected. So is there any, like, cognitive dissonance sometimes between I wanted to restore the relationship to what I had before the damage occurred, and this is what we're able to get to now?
Yeah, I think that you're calling a wise differentiation between this, because the idea is that most of the problem that you have with restoration, because quite frankly, it's pretty clear if the party that the victimizer, it's pretty clear whether they're going to be open to restoring the relationship or not. I mean, it's not hard to tell whether they're trustworthy or loving now. I mean, it's a pretty clear-cut thing. The difficulty is on the victimizer's part is governing those sides. How do I deal with the fact that my parents still make mistakes? Mm-hmm. Now, I've forgiven them a lot. You know, maybe 95% in the years that I've worked with them. They still do some things, though, that drive me. And I think, you know, gosh, it sure feels a lot like the way it used to be able to hang in there and be able to focus on the restoration that has taken place rather than going back. For longing for, does that cure me? Do I still have bad days where I think, geez, I sure missed out a lot in childhood? Yeah, I did. That doesn't take those days away. It doesn't take away the grief, you know, but you see, That's more on my side of the fence than it is on their side of the fence. They can't really address those things. They can address love and trustworthiness, but not always in the same way. Well, so, these are fairly obvious. The idea of saying, you know, to be able to do that, to be able to move ourselves to a point where we're able to realistically say, is this a wise thing to move toward restoration? We have to say, well, what's been our luck in salvage work, if that's applicable? Have we been able to accept the fact that what is done is done? Realism. These people are not going to be perfect. They are going to make mistakes. The best they're going to do is probably about 80 to 90% correct. Do I have a commitment, a staying power, to be able to hang in there, even when they fail? And am I willing, this is a big deal, am I willing to accept what they do as loving and trustworthy? You know, a lot of people go into the work of restoration and forgiveness thinking, well, I'll allow you to try to see if you can pay me back, but I'm not sure that you ever will. Well, you know, if you don't have any willingness to accept what somebody's trying to do to restore and put back love and trustworthiness, you're really not in a position where you need to forgive them. Doesn't mean you can't do the work of forgiveness, but the work you need to do is back on the aisle of salvage. Does that make sense? Well, so these two stations are what we need to talk about then. The idea, first one is giving the opportunity for compensation. I'm a therapist. I hate this station. All right? I'm the one that wrote about it. I hate it. Because giving the opportunity for compensation means that we never talk about the big issue. It basically says, I give you the opportunity to work on things in small ways, a little at a time, over a long period of time, to see if you're trustworthy, and I build trustworthiness and love based on your current performance. And in the light of your current love and trustworthiness, the memory of the violation fades. That's it. The only thing is that I've seen it work over and over again with folks. As you would imagine, this is the preferred methodology of a lot of folks, precisely because I don't have to talk about the big issue. They want to restore the relationship in small ways. So think about it this way. like if I had a damaging relationship with someone and I didn't know where to begin, every time that I got in contact with them, well, it was the same old story. I get the same accusations and things like that. Many times what I'll do is I'll start with these folks and I'll say, go and get a post office box. And I want you to mail a postcard to the person that you want to give the opportunity for compensation. I want you to mail a postcard, make it three lines long, they write it in my office, and they mail it, and the return address is the post office box. Right? Don't give them email. Don't give them any kind. Just the post office box. So typical is that, how are you? Just want to let you know that I'm fine. Maybe drop me a line sometime. You know, that's typical of what these, I send that off. Well, if what comes back is a 9-page diatribe about why have you not written me and you have a lot of nerve of getting in touch with me and let me tell you all the things I've done wrong, and, you know, I was pretty sure that that well is dry. Say in Texas, that hole is dry. Well, that didn't cost me much. It hurt some, but it's like I just dropped the postcard in, and that's what I got back. I'm not going any further. But let's say we get back a 1-page letter that says, you know, here's how things are. I'm glad you've written. I'd like to have more contact. Well, maybe I write a longer letter then. And if what comes back is an appropriate letter, then maybe I set up a time where I have a time-limited phone call, where I just make a short contact for about 15 minutes and see how it went. If that's okay, you see, it's costing me a little bit more. I'm investing a little bit more each time. Maybe we can invest in a longer conversation. And if that goes well, maybe we can actually meet for a coffee with a third party present. Mm-hmm. And we can actually see one another. And if that goes well, maybe there's time that we can actually spend an extended period of time, like over at dinner or something like that. You see, what I'm doing is I'm sequentially building levels of interaction and trustworthiness and love. And while I'm doing that, the past seems to not matter as much. Now, I see people that do this for 2 or 3 years, they end up having a pretty good relationship for a lot of reasons. You know, people, like I want to repeat, some people don't stay jackasses all their lives. They actually learn. If I had another chance, I'd do it better. And they do it better. Some people actually make the effort to really clean up their act. But here's the deal. They won't do it perfectly. So you have to work with the victim to be able to say, you know, this isn't going to go perfectly. This isn't going to be one try and out. And the first sign of difficulty, I'm all the way out. Maybe I need to back up a few spaces. Maybe I give them more time for integration. Maybe I talk about that, get some insight to it. But I don't just automatically bolt. Now, you know, if it keeps on happening, obviously, I need to just go back and work the work of salvage. I can still forgive, just maybe the wrong place and wrong time. This kind of forgiveness is always believing in possibilities. I would tell you that this is what Jesus was talking about with the rich young ruler. He was saying, you want forgiveness? Sell everything you have and follow me. The rich young ruler is kind of like, no, I can't do that. That's too much, too hard. Well, Jesus employed this at certain points to test people. It's okay to test. Forgiveness doesn't mean that you'd never, never test. You know, people that are working through affairs, we often employ this strategy when I'm working through an affair. I have to learn how to trust my spouse again. How do I do that? Little incremental steps where I'm trying out the fact of leaning into the relationship. That means that I check sometimes. You mean you're forgiving me and you're checking up on me in work? Yep. Because if you're where you say you're going to be, I'm going to actually make that count. Mm-hmm. You see the difference? But sometimes we get crazy ideas that, oh, well, if I forgive somebody, you know, I hear this over and over again. I particularly hear it from males after an affair. You're just going to have to trust me. I always look at them and say, no, they don't need to just trust you. What you're going to have to do is you're going to have to restore trustworthiness a little at a time or a long period of time. I'll help you. But that means that there are going to be some limitations that you're going to run into. It's fair. Does that make sense? What we're doing when we give the opportunity for compensation, you're stabilizing justice. You know, Paul Tillich, who is a famous theologian, to be really honest with you, I didn't understand much of what I read of Tillich. But I did understand one book, Love, Justice, and Power. In that, Tillich basically says this. He says, any forgiveness worth its salt not only is about love, but it also is about justice and power. Because if forgiveness is about love, then anything or everything will be forgiven, which makes love fairly paltry. On the other hand, if all you have in forgiveness is justice and power, then that, my friends, is called vengeance. And I think we know where that belongs, right? It's only with God. It's only when we get love, justice, and power in balance that we really have forgiveness with integrity. When we're giving opportunity for compensation, you see how we're addressing the issue of justice, fairness. We're stabilizing forgiveness through justice. And understanding that compassion thing that we just got through talking about, we're stabilizing the area of love. We're letting love stabilize the other two. In insight, we're actually stabilizing power. You see how there's a method to the madness? All three will build on one another and work for stabilization around the board, around the horn. Well, let's get this final idea out on the framework so we can answer some questions. The overt act of forgiveness. This is the big kahuna, right? This is where we actually, victim and victimizer, sit down in front of one another and they're going to have the big discussion. Now, I think that a victim and victimizer can do this by themselves, but quite frankly, it's better with a third party along. Mainly because there are three objectives that any kind of confrontation of overt forgiveness. Because what you're trying to do is you're trying to have a meeting between two people, victim and victimizer, and you're trying to spank new life of love and trustworthiness into the relationship spontaneously, right there, right then. Sounds pretty magical, right? Well, it happens though. All the time, people forgive one another. People come in enemies, they leave hand in hand. But you have to be wise. There are things that you have to do. First of all, is you have to get some agreement. What was the heart of the violation? You know, we spent all this time talking about the roots of pain. We talk about that for a particular reason. This is that the root of pain is not in the severity of what you think the action was. Because I guarantee you, I see plenty of people that look just as psychotic who were just manipulated by their parents as those who were sexually abused heinously by their parents. It's not because one was sexually abused and one was manipulated. It was the violation of love and trustworthiness. That's the common denominator between all. That's why you have some people that suffer severe traumatic injury and don't look any worse than those that just had simple little t trauma. When we're talking about agreement, we're talking about the heart of the violation. What was the heart of the violation? And let me tell you, the more specific you get, the more dangerous it will be. And so you need to get victim and victimizer in the same ballpark. You don't need to get them in the same seat. Like, for instance, the same seat would be, you know, you sexually abused me every Saturday night from ages 8 to 14. Well, if I'm going for that level of agreement, there's little to no chance. If I'm going for the agreement, you sexually abused me. I was sexually abused by you. I can get that level of agreement. I can get that same ballpark agreement, the heart of the violation. And that's the kind of agreement that we're looking for. The second signpost that we're looking for is an acknowledgement. When I say acknowledgement, I'm talking about on the victimizer's part. And to tell you the truth, this is where forgiveness actually happens in terms of justice. Because if I've been done wrong by a family member, I'm obligated to carry that burden of responsibility with me. You did me wrong. I'm holding you responsible for what you did to me. When the victimizer acknowledges responsibility that they did me wrong, you see, the responsibility rolls off me onto him or her. I no longer have to hold them responsible. They hold themselves responsible. Does that make sense? That's where the magic of exoneration can take place. And it's pretty heady stuff. And then there's an apology. Apology can come in a lot of different forms. But, you know, the realistic form is that it's basically a promise. It says, if I had the chance to do it over again, this is what I'd do. This is what I'd do. I would do it differently. It may come out saying, I'm asking you for your forgiveness because I want to do better. I want our relationship. You know, I want our relationship different. It can come out a variety of ways. But the idea is that I will take responsibility to do differently from here. That's the idea. That's the essence. Does that make sense? Well, you get those three things going, man, you're in business. Now, I'm just telling you as a therapist, you know, I do these forgiveness sessions from time to time. You know, some people just have to have the face-to-face confrontation, and I totally understand that. I'm totally supportive of that if that's what they feel like they have to do. You know, the way I handle that is I call up the victimizer myself. You know, I get a release from my client. I call up the victimizer. I say, here's the deal. Your son or daughter or your family member wants to try to work things out with you. If you have any interest in doing that, I can guarantee you three things. Is that one is that I won't let things become damaging. If they start becoming damaging on either end, I'll stop the session. Right. Second thing is you don't have any obligation to ever come back to me for this. This is the one-time thing to see if you can make things better. The third thing is that I want to hear your side of the story, what happened from your side of the framework. But we're going to try to make things better. If you want to participate, you're welcome to come. That's usually what I say. It's usually about a 10 to 15 minute call. You know, I don't have 100% of people taking me up on that, but I will tell you that I have about 80 to 85% of people taking me up on that. They show up. Now, what I've learned therapeutically through the hard way is that you cannot do this in an hour. But you better do it before 2 hours. So what I'm saying is the target time for this is usually about 90 minutes. Because if you start going over that time, people's patience run thin and you increase the likelihood that things are going to go wrong. So here's the bad news. So I'm talking 90 minutes, right? Here's the really bad news. Agreement takes about 75 of those minutes. What? Yeah. It takes that long to hear a story and get agreement on what the crux of the violation is about. Now, if you get that, then acknowledgement and apology are going to fall out very, very quickly. It's not going to be difficult to do. But just to let you know, when you're helping people along with it, these are the signposts that help keep you on track. It's always nice to have a trail guide along, whether you're a pastor, whether you're a friend, whether you're just a well-meaning person that wants to do well. It's good to have somebody along to keep those two along the pathway to climb this giant mountain. But I can tell you that I've seen it happen over and over again with folks. People come in enemies, they leave arm in arm. Yeah.
So is there a limit at which you would say, ministerially, you would say, here's a boundary that I'm not comfortable with? You've got to move from here to professional health.
Yeah, I think so. I think sometimes, I think as a pastor you can do that in your pastoring time, but I don't think it is a requirement for you to do that, because sometimes it gets out of your expertise or out of bounds of what's going on. But I can imagine some folks being able to do this without any issue at all. Okay, some questions, yeah. I'm going to open up a little. We have a few minutes for questions.
In the agreement, more specifically, it's arranged. Maybe I didn't pay attention closely. The reason behind that is I can see myself as a victim. You know, I need to hear them say specifically what they did. I mean, we're keeping this in darkness. They're minimizing this.
Yeah, and I'm always going to let the victim guide that. So if you tell me I have to hear that, then I'm going to say, I totally understand.
But it's dangerous.
But the thing that I want you to know, from my viewpoint, working with this a lot, that's harder to get. So you have to be prepared that you may not be able to get that with that much detail. So you have to ask those questions. But, you know, that's the victim has the right to ask for what they need. You know, and I'm not going to try to talk them out of it. I just want them realistic about what the requirements are around that. You know, some people will do the funniest things. So they'll talk about forgiveness, and they'll get some nonverbal, and they'll say, "Well, when he or she did that, that nonverbal communicated to me that it's okay." I think, well, that was a rule that I'm not able to read. You know, that's a language I'm not able to read. But if you read it that way, and that's what you needed, that's what is good.
I was hearing you say one other thing. When I made that phone call, there's three things. The third thing was, I want to hear your side of the story. And so what you're open to at that point is, this may not be the victim here, victimizer. I'm open to consideration. You may not be the victimizer. I want to hear, is that what you're saying?
You may not be the victimizer. And a lot of these sessions are messy that way. And as a helper, you have to be prepared that it's going to be messy, that it's not just going to be clean. Unfortunately, it doesn't work, you know, like our modern day social media, where there's clearly bad guy and good guy. You know, it's just not true always.
Yeah, I was going to ask how much of this, when there's obvious things where there's a violation of something, how much of this miscommunication that happened a long time ago, or misinterpretation?
Very seldom is it about miscommunication. You'll get a lot of layers of defensiveness that says you just misinterpreted. Well, I never did that. But again, what I want to say is the heart of the issue is, say, were you moving the ball forward in building identity or trustworthiness? When I boil it down to that, people say, well, yeah, I do. I would no. I say, okay, then tell me about that part of it though, where you're saying no. Back here, and then we'll come over here.
I'm struggling with this level of detail, given much of what you previously have said. If, as a victim and a Christian, I have an obligation to forgive, and I can't get to this level with the person that has victimized, that, that is the victimizer. I had understood everything that you previously had said as suggesting that what forgiveness looks like in any particular situation may be less extensive than this, and may indeed involve just things that happen in my own head. Would you agree with that? I mean, mm-hmm. isn't this sort of the ideal that may simply not be able to be accomplished in yeah. some circumstances, but that doesn't absolve the victim of the obligation to forgive?
Exactly. I still can do the work of forgiveness even if I fail at overt forgiveness.
But isn't, maybe I'm just picking up the phrase overt act of forgiveness. What you're talking about is forgiveness that involves a mutual confrontation. Mm-hmm. As victim, I would think that I have an obligation to do an overt act of forgiveness even if I can't get mutuality in confrontation. In other words, if I can't get my victimizer to engage, I nevertheless have an obligation to do what I can to forgive that person, even if they're unwilling to acknowledge that they've done wrong.
And I would say, absolutely. As long as you're talking about giving in the same vein and the same flexibility of what Jesus forgave. He was, I absolutely believe Jesus is the forgiveness guy, right? He's about the work of forgiveness no matter what. So even those stories where I can't find overt forgiveness, I assume that he's working toward forgiveness. That's what I'm saying. So, we are obligated. Jesus, none of what I'm saying, I want you to understand, is saying me excusing ourselves from the idea that we are obligated to forgive. We are obligated to forgive. Jesus makes that clear. I'm just trying to say what we've understood traditionally as the only methodology of forgiveness, Jesus didn't exactly employ that. Is that what we're looking for is not just letting go, but also this idea of putting back. Yeah, over here, and then we'll...
Kind of a precursor to the course, maybe, too, is what to look for, what to recognize in before there can be the attempt at forgiveness and restoration. We have to move out of the anger into the next step. And how to kind of sense when that's time or how to bring that along, one. And for lack of a better way of saying that, a secondary victim. In the case of adultery, you know, the husband and wife are working on these steps if there's to be restoration in the marriage. But for the children, the adult children, that are very, very angry, how do you get them, or how do you help them along that path? Because, you know, mom is stupid because she's talking to dad still. You know, there's so many pieces of that puzzle that you're watching these secondary victims, if you will, suffer and not move along the path.
Yeah, and you have to understand that forgiveness is the antidote, but that doesn't eradicate the sickness. And so not everybody's going to take the antidote. So you have to make room for this. Once the violation occurs, it will go where it's going to go. But I also want to say is that everybody has a voice in what they do in terms of forgiving. There's this famous story about a Russian rabbi that was traveling to another town to do some lectures in a synagogue. And on the train, he's a quite famous rabbi, but he was treated shabbily by people that lived in the village that he was going to. And when he got off the train and the village rabbi greeted him, and these guys realized, oh, that's the rabbi. And they felt really bad about this and stuff like this, so they went to the rabbi's house and they knocked on the door, and the town rabbi came and said, so what can I do for you? And the guy said, well, we treated the chief rabbi shabbily and we want to apologize and ask his forgiveness. So the village rabbi went back to this other guy and he says, so I understand that there was problems. These guys are here. They're wanting forgiveness. Chief rabbi says, oh,
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
And so he goes back to the door and says, he says, no. And so the guys came back about an hour later and they said, oh my God, we really are sorry. We really, you know, please let us forgive. Ask for forgiveness. And so the rabbi went to the chief rabbi and said, you know, these guys look sincere. You know, I know these men. They really look sorry. Won't you forgive them? You know, sort of like, do this. And the chief rabbi says, well, they did nothing to me. He said, if they want to ask for forgiveness, let them go find the man that they thought I was. Uh-huh. And ask forgiveness from that man. In other words, he's rightly defining who has the right to forgive. You know, a lot of times we get in problems when we think that we have the right to forgive somebody that we don't have the right to forgive. In pronouncing forgiveness over somebody. You know, I'm always suspicious of self-forgiveness. I see utility in it, but I'm always suspicious of self-forgiveness. I'll forgive myself. Well, I'm not sure you have the authority. You might. I don't know. But also, when we're talking about secondary victims, they have their own list of wrongs. And just because I've forgiven my spouse does not mean that my child is obligated to the forgiveness. That has to be handled separately. And it may or may not involve me. I may not be able to address it at all. It's the person that the violation belongs with that has to. I just want to wrap up with one last thing, just to tell you that, you know, the story, just one story from really the remarkable work. You know, I entered the work of forgiveness from my gut. You can tell I've done a lot of work with my family just by the stories that I tell. But I'd be remiss if I didn't tell you at least one story of this. About 5 years into the work, after I started having children, my parents came to visit because we had a new child. I unabashedly rocked and sang to my children every night, you know, mainly for me, not for them. It was healing for me. And I noticed one night my mother's silhouette outside the door, rocking back and forth. And then about 6 months later, I was in her home and I was watching her work with a student. She was a school teacher and she was working with a student. I said, you're quite patient with that student. You know, I couldn't resist, so I just had to dig her a little bit. I said, you know, why weren't you patient like that with us? She said, oh, well, I was worried about so many things with you guys, you know. But then she turned serious and she said, you know, I didn't hold you children enough. I think that came from my family. I kind of parked that in my head. About a year later, we were actually moving back to the town where I was raised. My parents still lived in the town. And while we were moving back, they were away on a mission trip with their church in Brazil. And so some of our friends, we had some friends in common that came back from the trip early. My parents stayed behind to do some touring. These friends came over. And one of the women looked at me and said, Terry, I never knew your mother. She is such a nurturing woman. And I swear, I promise you, I looked at her, and my first thought was, you've got my mother confused with somebody. Because never in my life had I had her described as a nurturing woman. Until I heard this story. She could tell I was confused, so she said, your mother chose as her mission the tuberculosis wing in the hospital where the young children were going to be quarantined for 3 to 6 months. And every day from sunrise to sunset, she went and she would hold and sing and rock those children all day. Long.
And I looked at her and I said, that's my mother. So when she showed back up, about the children in the hospital. And my mom hung her head. She looked at me and she said, if I had it to do over again, that's what I would have done for you. You see, forgiveness is actually about creating the possibility of restoring love and trustworthiness. And my parents have had a long 23-year career at this point of loving and rocking my children. More importantly, loving and creating safety for me. I'm a better man and a better father because of that effort on their part. And my children better than I am because of that trustworthy effort. Thank you so much for being here. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your questions. I'll hang around if you have some follow-up questions, because I know we had some hands up that we didn't quite finish with. But thanks for coming. Appreciate your time.